What is it that creates this unfavorable impression the others have of her? There's a mirror, Adrialine. Go on, look at yourself. Like a lot of boys and girls, your posture is your problem.
Self-improvement is hardly a new thing, but it's certainly gone into overdrive in digital culture. The endless productivity apps, the fitness devices, the clickbait news articles that promise
5 steps to healthy aging,
or
the biggest mistake you're making in your relationship.
And then there's social media, which can sometimes seem like a rushing torrent of tips for personal betterment and humble brags about how much better other people are. And in the workplace, people are constantly being told to adapt, keep up, or else. It's exhausting. So what if we just say no? That's right, just put on our no hat.
Yeah, we have this expression in Danish, the yes hat. So if people don't want to do something, they are often told by an authority to, well, you have to put on the yes hat. And so I invented the no hat, told people to put on the no hat, because there's so much we have to say no to, we should say no to.
This is Sven Brinkmann. He's the author of the book Stand Firm, Resisting the Self-Improvement Craze. It was a runaway bestseller when it came out in Denmark. It's an anti-self-help book in the form of a self-help book. 7 Steps to Overcoming Self-Improvement. Now that it's available in English, I wanted to know how we can stop the runaway train of self-improvement and why we need to.
First, I think, and I'm a psychologist, so I see this from a psychological perspective, but I think it's really doing us much harm that we have to be constantly flexible, adaptable, movable. We're not allowed to put down roots, but have to be constantly on the move. And we see the consequence in the large number of people who suffer from stress, stress-related disorders, even depression. But there's another line of, or another set of consequences that are, have more to do with our lives as ethical beings, I believe. There is a precondition for ethical life related to what some philosophers call self-constancy, that we have to be the same person across different times and contexts in order for others to be able to count on us. So the problem is that if we're constantly becoming someone else, developing individually, then it's difficult to establish long-term commitments in our lives, which is a precondition of ethics.
Yeah, I think maybe even for North Americans in particular, there's this persistent feeling of rootlessness, as though the ground is not entirely solid beneath our feet.
Right. Yeah, in a way, it's an old diagnosis of modernity. Even in the 19th century, Karl Marx, in the Communist Manifesto, wrote that all that is solid melts into air.
Yeah.
And that was more than 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And I believe now that has really intensified, especially with new technologies, social media, constant restructuring, disruption, all these dynamic words that we have. We have to engage in lifelong learning. We work in learning organizations. And I don't think human beings are built for that kind of thing. Of course, it's good that we can be creative and develop new ideas, but we really need some firm ground to stand on in order for us to thrive as human beings.
Mm-hmm. So we have some tough love in the book, so to say. You start by arguing, yeah, quit navel-gazing, stop looking for your true self. What's the problem with all of that introspection and trying to find your one true voice?
Well, first of all, and this is sort of a philosophical discussion, I don't believe in the idea of an inner true self. If you look at the world's cultures, this idea that whom we really are is an inner private core. That is a very historically recent and contingent idea. That idea functions actually to alienate us from others and from the world. It turns us into ourselves and ultimately makes it difficult for us to find meaning in life, because we're told by, you know, the self-help books and all the personal improvement coaches and stuff like that, that the answers are within myself. I think that is simply wrong. That's an individualist ideology as I see it. If there is meaning in life, it's found in our relationships, in our connections to culture, to nature, to communities, societies, all that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, undergirding a lot of what you're arguing here is this sense of that meaning in some way is created in our relationships with other people, in doing our duty to other people and so forth. Can you expand on that a little bit?
I guess I can give you an example. I have three kids, and the oldest is now 14. And when he was born, one of my good friends, and she's a philosopher, she said, "Congratulations, now you have the meaning of your life secured for the next 18 years. And of course, it was to make a sort of a joke. But there was some truth to the idea that meaning is given in the fact that I had become a father. It didn't really matter what I felt inside. Obviously, I loved him and I love him and I have warm feelings when I think of my kids. But even when I don't have these warm feelings, because my kids are misbehaving or they wake me up in the middle of the night, there's still duty. I have a duty towards him and my other kids, of course. And it's a deeply meaningful relationship. So meaning is something I find. It's something that I meet in my connections and relationships to others. It's not something I discover within myself or create out of nothing.
You also say we should suppress our feelings. How come?
Yes. All my steps or stages are mimicking regular self-help lingo, but I turn them upside down. We have what some sociologists call a culture of emotional capitalism. Our emotions, our selves, if you will, have become commodities. We are only good enough as persons in the workplace or in the dating marketplace if we are authentic and display our emotions. And I think there's a danger to sort of giving our emotional lives away in that sense. I think there is much to be gained from relearning to wear masks. I think social life works best when there is some sort of structure and when people are willing to, you know, not express every feeling they might have whenever they might have that feeling.
But isn't part of the reason why those masks, as you put it, you know, why we sort of overturned that was because they were reinforcing certain kinds of hierarchies that we believed were no longer legitimate or ought to be challenged.
Right. That's a good point. When we moved away from, you know, the 40s and 50s in the Western world, that was a culture with oppressive social structures, hierarchies, as you said. It was really liberating. It was emancipatory at that time to say, now I want to express myself. Now I want to realize myself. But now we have sort of emancipated, liberated ourselves to some extent. But the question is, to what? What have we become free to do? We have mainly become free to pursue whatever feeling or whatever impulse we have. We have become free to realize ourselves. And that has become a new duty. So that's the new kind of burden. And that doesn't really make us free. Rather, I think it makes us, and I apologize for putting it in a quite dramatic way, but it makes us into slaves of our impulses. And who decides what kinds of impulses we have in our inner lives? Well, all sorts of, you know, media, marketing, advertising. We have so many different wants all the time. I quote in the book Leonard Cohen. I love his poetry and his songs. And he has these nice lines. He says, "I know that I'm forgiven, but I don't know how I know. I don't trust my inner feelings. Inner feelings come and go." So if we only have our inner feelings to trust and go by, then we have something that is really fragile and probably too fragile to serve as an existential and ethical foundation in our lives.
You are also arguing, it seems to me, that there's almost a hidden agenda here, right? I mean, this self-improvement sounds like it's great for us as individuals, but that, in fact, the whole change, adapt thing is useful at a kind of social level, for example, in producing compliant workers, if we always feel like, well, it's up to me to change and adapt.
Yeah. Many of the words that we have to describe our lives now, they were good, they were positive, they were useful. the whole self-realization vocabulary, talking about personal development, talking about the whole person, talking about lifelong learning and creativity and thinking outside of the box and all this. These are, in principle, good things. But my analysis is that they have been stolen and are now part of an ideology that presents itself to us in the form of new duties, as I said. And it's a very individualist ideology that says that you have the power to become happy and successful and realize yourself. You have the power to choose happiness. Happiness is a personal choice, etc., etc. And it leaves the individual alone. Whenever you fail, it's your own fault. You only have yourself to blame. And that's very lonely. And it actually, I believe, betrays the relational character of human beings.
When you read the book, and it has these sort of tongue-in-cheek things of basically doing things like say no to things, is the book in some ways pointing out the absurdity of trying to tackle these issues at an individual level at all?
Yes, I haven't really made up my mind myself about the book, whether to see it as just pure parody of a self-help book. In some ways, it is that. But in another way, I've met readers who have followed my steps and who say that their lives have improved very much, and it has helped them out of their depression and stuff like that. And I think that's fantastic, but that's not why I wrote it. So on the one hand, you can read it as a cultural critique that is disguised as a self-help book, perhaps the last self-help book we will need. And when we read it, we'll understand that we can throw away all self-help books, including mine. But in another sense, you can actually see it as a real self-help book.
As I understand it, this book, when it originally came out in Danish, was a huge hit, a huge bestseller. Why do you think it struck such a chord?
People feel that they're under pressure. Even though Denmark is a very rich welfare country, it's a well-functioning society, we have around 8 to 10% of the Danish population who suffer from depression and take antidepressant medication. And they are often told to, you know, just do mindfulness exercises, just get rid of the negative thoughts, just be yourself. You know, those might be good pieces of advice. But I think that people are beginning to understand that we cannot solve these problems individually. We have to change more fundamental ideas and practices in our society. And I think my book is trying to articulate a new kind of language to talk about our problems. We have to look at culture, at context, at organizations, at politics, at social structures, etc. I think that is what is appealing to many readers of my book, that it directs their attention in a way away from themselves and say, well, you're good enough. There's not something wrong with you if you break down with stress. It might be your workplace that is the problem. So that realization might provide a ground for new kinds of solidarity and political action.
At the same time, though, you say that some of your readers have found actually implementing this to be helpful to them. Spend it from time to time on the show, we like to give people homework. So if there's one piece of particularly resonant, you know, stoic advice that somebody could try out in their life this week, what would it be?
My step number 6 is read a novel, not a self-help book. Throw those away. Choose a novel instead. Because even though novels are works of fiction, the best of them are much truer to the human condition. When they succeed, they portray human life in all its complexity, with all its troubles, and that is deeply consoling. Whereas self-help books, they are linear, they have these 7-step or whatever 10-step structure, and you can only fail. And that's why we have so many self-help books, because none of them work. Don't buy them, read a novel instead.
Okay, read a novel right after we finish reading your self-help book.
Yes, please.
Okay. Sven, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.